Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Pearl Harbor edition of the show as we mark the 74th anniversary on December 7th. We heard how one sailor aboard the USS Pennsylvania experienced the attack. Now let's hear from Sam Freifield of Eugene, Oregon. He had been transferred from a destroyer to the light cruiser USS Detroit, and he was very tuned into world affairs. He was pretty convinced that America would soon end up at war.
I don't know what anybody else believed.
Right.
From my own observations, I could see that the war was coming, but I will not ever brag that I knew it was coming or anything. I agreed with the assessment of the big shots that it was going to be the Philippines. So when it did happen, I wasn't totally surprised.
Well, and it was the Philippines too, pretty much simultaneously. But you didn't know it was coming to you there on Oahu. Yeah. So that Sunday morning, where were you? How did you realize that America was under attack? Walk me through those moments if you can.
Well, I had slept late, and I was the last man in chow line. It was topside, and it was right up near the top of the ladder to go down to the mess hall. I heard an explosion, and I ran out to the rail. I looked aft, and the debris was still coming down. A torpedo had hit the Utah. Then I heard a plane. I looked out midships, and here was a plane dropping a torpedo in my lap. I don't know for sure what happened. In the book, it went aft. It went between us and the Raleigh and went up on the shore. Somebody else said that it went underneath, but in the official war diary, it missed, went.
So when you say right in your lap, you're at the rail of the ship, and you see a plane heading right at your ship?
Yeah.
And it drops the torpedo into the water right in front of your ship?
Probably 200 or 300 yards out when we dropped it.
Wow. So then you're just waiting for something to happen.
Oh, no. One doesn't wait. One runs to a battle station.
Yes, sir.
Post haste.
And where was your battle station?
In way aft in the chief's quarters. And we handled the ammunition for the surface guns. We had 6-inch guns. Well, since we didn't use the 6-inch guns for the air attack, well, I think there were 10 or 12, I don't remember how many men, 10 or 12 of us sat down there for over 2 hours chewing our fingernails. We could hear distantly the big booms of the battleships getting hit, and also the hundreds of rounds that of a 3-inch 50, we could hear that going off a huge amount.
But you guys needed to be there in case someone decided to use the big guns.
That was our battle station.
Right.
So when they said, load it up, well, we would have sent the rounds up to the turret.
And how did that work? How did you get them there?
There's an elevator, which was to prevent fires from reaching the magazine down below. And then to make sure that any explosion wasn't going to transfer from one end to the other.
Right. So that's where you were.
That's where I was.
For 2 hours.
For over 2 hours.
What was going through your head?
well, I almost got shot.
How'd that happen?
I worked in a pay office.
Right.
And one of my senior petty officers was Chief Grignon. I was in the chief's quarters, and all of those who had been eating jumped up and went to their battle stations. So the tables had this food on them. I had not had a breakfast. So I was reaching for a slice of toast on one table, and Grignon, who being the petty officer in charge of the group, told me to leave it alone, put his hand on the 45. I went without breakfast.
I guess so. It would have been a real tragic story of the guy who died on December 7th because of a piece of toast.
Yes, that's one thing.
So when you finally emerged from there.
The first thing that they had us do, there were a large number of shell casings from the 3-inch 50 especially lying about on the deck. I and several others were put to work to throw them over. Then we were low on fuel. We had come in on Friday, low on fuel. We were planning to refuel. They said, no, come in tomorrow. But then they said, later on, they said, no, wait until Monday. So we were low on fuel. So now we were ordered, go over there and get some fuel. Then we headed out, going to the coast of the island to see if the Japanese were trying to land troops anyplace.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you something. When you mentioned being low on fuel, and you alluded to the torpedo earlier, and you said there are differing theories on what happened with it, but if it did indeed go under your ship, the fact that you were low on fuel may have saved you, right?
That was my usual statement until a few years ago, especially after reading this, I decided, no, it did go between us and the Raleigh.
And explain to us where you guys were positioned that morning, because I'm sure some people maybe have been to the Arizona Memorial and they've seen the diagrams, or maybe they've read some books about it, but there are a whole lot of ships in a whole lot of different places. Where was the Detroit when this happened?
We were moored at what's called Fox 13 along Ford Island, which is maybe a half mile from where Battleship Row was.
Right.
There's the Detroit. The Raleigh, another four-stack cruiser, was behind us. Then the Utah and the Tangier. Now, this was normally a place where aircraft carrier would have been tied up. Mm-hmm. Now, aircraft carrier would draw more water than we would.
Absolutely.
So I, at one time, felt that both things, blow on fuel and being where a carrier would be, that pilot didn't know what he was doing. He saw a ship there where it was supposed to be a ship, and he dropped his torpedo, which was set to go low enough that it would get the carrier.
Right.
But it was too low to hit a light cruiser.
Especially one that was low on fuel and was sitting higher in the water.
Yeah.
So whether that happened or it went between you and the Raleigh, what you do know is the Raleigh was hit and the Utah was sunk.
Yeah.
So your ship was pretty fortunate to not be hit.
Yes, we were. Anyway, we left there, we fueled, then we headed out and went out looking, as I say, for the Japanese fleet or any activities. Didn't find it, came back in. We were there for a couple of days, and then we took off convoy duty, headed for San Francisco.
Well, and there was probably a scramble to get you out of the harbor so you wouldn't be trapped in there.
One of the things, it's reported that we went out there in a hurry so that any subs firing would not get us.
Right.
Well, we didn't get hit, so I don't know if they had any.
And even though you're out there looking for possible Japanese forces, you didn't find any. And that's probably a good thing, too?
Yes. Because there was a heavy cruiser and a light cruiser and some destroyers.
So you wouldn't have been a very imposing collection of American forces if you ran into some serious Japanese ships. Oh, and while you were below deck, prepared to load that ammunition, you mentioned hearing the different things happening. And you heard the explosion that took down the Arizona?
Probably the Arizona. That one was a mighty one.
Can you help us understand what that did to your ship, to those men, to what your mindset now became in the wake of this surprise attack? Did it anger you? Did it motivate you? Did you notice something different about your ship afterwards?
I really had so little social contact that I can't give you anything more than my own feelings on that. A feeling that I said it was coming and it did. I knew that much. I just lived my life aboard whatever. I did whatever I was supposed to do, did it to the best of my ability. I did have to ask for the transfer in order to get promoted. So that's why I went to the Proteus ultimately. But as for the spirit of the men of the ship, I have no recollection of formulating.
Sure. No, and I understand that. And I'm sure you know why I'm asking, because, you know, it did have such an impact on the nation. And that rallying cry of remember Pearl Harbor, and even the song, you know, that became popular, was something that galvanized not just the Navy, but the entire nation. So I was just curious how that worked for you, if it motivated you to fight this war.
I must have been a fatalist, because I just said, well, I joined the Navy to do whatever they told me to do. And if it said to fire a gun, I would. If they told me to pay off a couple of sailors, I'd do that.
It didn't stir big emotions for you.
Psychologically and philosophical thoughts were few and far between. I hope that I wouldn't get into a battle. May I point out,
sure,
side issue,
yep,
other than that torpedo which was dropped and intended for our ship, I never got shot at again in the whole war.
How about that? That's not easy to do. So you had a big one coming at you at the very beginning.
The very first day, that one, and no more after that.
With the significance of Pearl Harbor, I'm sure that, you know, in all the reunions over the years, certainly you've thought about it. I'm sure that every December 7th, it's something that comes to mind for you.
I'm very sympathetic for what would be a huge group, people I never knew, but who were part of my life, too. In other words, the families of 1,100 men killed in one ship. I did have some thoughts about that. That was bitter, bitter thoughts. Thoughts of, oh boy, I wish I had somehow known I could warn, but yeah, that was dreaming.
Yeah, and that was the Arizona. There's more than twice that number total when
oh,
you
yes.
think about the Utah and the Oklahoma and everyone else that was killed that day. Did you ever think that could have been me?
Oh, yes.
Oh, torpedo yes. did that for you, I guess, huh?
Yeah, that gave me a notice that it was possible.
Have you been back there?
Oh, yes, several times.
What do you experience? What kind of emotions come to mind when you go there?
The first time, an emotion of which included the 2,400. Then seeing that Arizona memorial said these guys deserved life, but they paid the price so that the rest of us could have life.
Amen.
That's about it. Now, the next time my wife and I went on a cruise, we went to the islands. So naturally, when we went to Oahu, well, I said, well, we're going to go out to the memorial. All right. We went out there, and I was the only visiting Pearl Harbor survivor. We got in line to get into the movie. All of a sudden, I had my hat on.
Your Pearl Harbor survivor's
yeah.
hat, sure.
All of a sudden, here's this other survivor comes running over. Come with me. Come on. Took me in, opened the door. Hold it a minute. I got some important people here. He was saying to the other people.
Right.
Took us in, set us down, seats way up front. We got ready to go. I mean, got it all finished. He says, hold it. I got important people here. Took us out. These young kids are saluting me. And I was a chief. A chief, you don't salute.
Right.
But that's all right, son. But that was nice being honored that much.
Sure.
There I did feel sort of proud that I was one of those who put in four years to see that the people back there on the West Coast didn't have to learn to speak Japanese.
And to make sure that those 2,400 didn't die in vain.
They didn't die in vain.
And while we're on that topic, again, since we're talking Pearl Harbor, let's stay there for a little while. If you're down to 1,500 now, in a few years from now, it's going to be down to zero. What do you want the rest of us to remember? When you say remember Pearl Harbor, what is it that we need to learn from what happened all those years ago?
Just learn that it is possible for a group of people to lay down their lives, to offer at least their life, in hopes of preserving the country that they've grown up in.
Mm-hmm.
And the life that they have had, and pass it on to their children, their grandchildren, and that's about it.
Well said. That is Sam Fryfield, still going strong in Eugene, Oregon, as he approaches his 94th birthday. When we come back, two brothers on the USS Oklahoma. One was killed on December 7th, 1941. The other survived against significant odds. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Effler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. If you're an RVer, you've probably heard about the new line of Grand Design fifth wheels, travel trailers, and toy haulers. What sets Grand Design apart is the long list of premium standard features you'll find on the entire line. You'll also find the largest selection of Grand Design RVs at Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states and online at rvcountry.com.